Hello, I'm Chris Mackerell. This is number 0543, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0543. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, we remember Broadway legend Jerry Herman, who passed away at the age of 88 on Boxing Day.
The first thing I ever saw was Annie Get Your Gun with Ethel Merman. I came home that night and I announced to my parents, I was just a kid, but I announced to my parents that that's what I wanted to do, that I wanted to write songs like that and I wanted to entertain people. It's always been a goal. My father thought I was crazy. My mother thought it was wonderful. I think I almost caused a divorce, but as good luck would have it, I found myself on Broadway in just a few years after my college graduation.
Sarah Kinnemont is the author of The Bucket Bleep It List, and you can pretty well guess what the bleep it is.
You know, it's a mix of like standard bucket list stuff, like going to the top of the Eiffel Tower, climbing Mount Fuji, things like that. But then there's also some really silly stuff that, you know, is not really that possible. Just to give you an idea of, you know, strange things that are out in the world. Some things are a little bit funnier, more irreverent. But I think it just kind of gives you sort of an idea of what's out there in the world. And hopefully, even though it is aspirational and pretty much a traditional bucket list book, hopefully it will make you laugh and you'll learn something at the same time. You'll be like, oh my gosh, I didn't even know that existed. So I think it's a good balance between the two.
Geert Wigan, who spends his time in Sweden humorously photographing squirrels, is not something a lot of people do.
6 years ago, there were some people who did this. Maybe three people in the world who really invested a lot of time. And afterwards, I see a lot of people duplicating what we are doing, and because it's fun. Still, it's very hard to do because the right background, the right light, the right squirrel, so it's not so easy. So even people try to imitate us, it's not easy to imitate.
And we have lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0543, was Chris Mackerell, who operates World FM in New Zealand, one of the many places where the Stuff File is heard. Thank you very much, Chris, for doing the guest late on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make the show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Actually, first of all, I know we're into the second week, but I'd like to wish all of our fine listeners out there a very merry and happy new year.
This is 2020.
When the ball came down in Times Square, 14,000 parking meters across New York City stopped taking credit cards. The City Department of Transportation explained that the necessary software had been configured with an end date of January 1st,
2020.
The Flowbird Group, which owns the software vendor, cited an anti-fraud setting. Payment can still be made through a smartphone app or with quarters. How are you going to find that many quarters? Asked Angelo Pagan, who managed to find in his pockets 8 quarters enough to rent his Manhattan parking spot for about 30 minutes. The city's finance department said the glitch would not be an excuse for getting a parking ticket, but the transportation department said it would talk to the finance department about that. Didn't we all go through this 20 years ago during Y2K? And by the way, I don't know what Angelo's problem with the quarters was. Stashed in my car, you could have found 3 plastic pill bottles, one filled with toonies, one filled with loonies, and the third filled with quarters. I was never at a loss for meter money or for payphones. And yes, I am that person who still occasionally uses a payphone. Okay, here's a quote from Nisa Lynn Parson of McKinney, Texas. She's talking about her 12-year-old son. Caden asked for a magnifying glass for Christmas. We thought, oh, he wants to magnify something. Okay, do the math, folks. This is the Stuff File News. And if you were ever a kid, you know what happens next. Caden had other ideas besides magnifying something. I just wanted to start a little fire, Caden admits. He and his older brother, Ashton, went out to the porch and focused the magnifying glass on a piece of newspaper, but were unclear of what to do once it was on fire. So I picked up the newspaper and I just kind of like throw it, Ashton explained. Soon the front lawn was on fire. The family was able to douse the flames, but not before the lawn and part of their Christmas lights were destroyed. This will be a story passed down to generations and generations, Nisa Lynn said. Remember the one year you lit the lawn on fire? Yeah, this will be a story that lasts a long time. Wow. Are we missing the obvious question here? How dry is your lawn? If the only time you water it is when it's on fire, that's a hint that it's not enough. Go back inside with your kids, Nisa Lynn, where you can all sit around singing, I fought the lawn and the lawn won. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first segment on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? A couple of weeks ago on our Best of Stuff File program, we featured the stars we were lucky enough to talk to over the years, who unfortunately passed away in 2019. There were five of them. After that show was put together, but just before the end of the year, we lost another giant of the entertainment world. Broadway composer Jerry Herman died on the day after Christmas at the age of 88. I had the pleasure and honor of speaking with the man behind such hits as Hello Dolly, Mame, and La Cage aux Folles, just to name a few. I spoke to Jerry back in October of 2001, just a month after 9/11. Here's part of that conversation now.
I was bitten by the Broadway bug because I had parents who loved Broadway musicals, and whenever they were able to afford a night out, they would take me to see the latest Broadway show. We lived in New York City, and so the first thing I ever saw was Annie Get Your Gun with Ethel Merman, and I came home that night and I announced to my parents, I was just a kid, but I announced to my parents that that's what I wanted to do, that I wanted to write songs like that and I wanted to entertain people. And it's always been a goal. My father thought I was crazy. My mother thought it was wonderful. I think I almost caused a divorce in the family. But as good luck would have it, I found myself on Broadway, and just a few years after my college graduation, and I was very young and very inexperienced. But I was nominated for a Tony Award for Milk and Honey, and there was no stopping me after that.
Now I'm just curious because you know there's a lot of youthful exuberance and bravado when you start something and you think you can do no wrong, no matter what job you're in. When you did that first Broadway play, did you think that, you know, this is a piece of cake, this is easy, I'm just rolling along singing a song as the song goes, or if you knew then what you knew now, would you realize how hard it was?
I had no idea how hard it was. To me, it was the culmination of a dream. I didn't think I would ever have a chance to write more than one Broadway show, because thinking any beyond that was over my head at that point. And here I was with a Broadway show. A producer trusted me because I really was an inexperienced kid, and it was a big hit, and I got this nomination for a Tony, and it all just hit me at once that A, it was very, very hard work, B, it was very stressful waiting for those reviews and collaborating with a whole rash of directors and actors and choreographers and orchestrators, and I learned while doing instead of learning it first and then setting out. But it was a very good way to learn, and I learned what mistakes I made. And one night, a man came to see Milk and Honey, whose name was David Merrick. And he was the famous producer of so many Broadway hits. And he asked if I would come and have a meeting with him in his office. And he offered me my next musical, which turned out to be Hello, Dolly. So it was very, very heady, you know, for a kid to have all this happening at the same time. I just thought, you know, don't spoil this rhythm that's going on here. Don't ask any questions. Just do the work and see what happens. And the rest, I guess, is history now.
Let's go back a little bit. You mentioned that you first saw Annie Get Your Gun with your mother when you were a young boy. Between the time that you made that very youthful decision that you wanted to do this type of thing for a living and the time that you actually got to Broadway, who were your idols? Whose music, whose work did you like and wanted to emulate as a lyricist?
It's always been Irving Berlin, because I loved the simplicity of his music and the simplicity of his lyrics, and yet the elegance and the long-lasting quality that they've had. I mean, we still sing God Bless America. We still sing There's No Business Like Show Business. And I admired his skill. It sounds like it's easy to write a simple song, but it truly isn't. It's difficult to do it in the space of a few notes and a few words. And I always wanted to be like Mr. Berlin. And if there is a figurehead hanging over me, it's always been that man. Obviously, I admire all of the great songwriters that came before before my time, like Gershwin and Cole Porter and just on and certainly Rodgers and Hammerstein. But I wanted to be more like Irving Berlin because of the ability that he gave me that night when I saw Annie Get Your Gun to remember three or four songs and to be able to go to the piano and play a couple of songs that I had never heard before. And I thought, what a great gift this gentleman has given me without knowing it. And that's what I really want to do.
Irving Berlin lived to be over 100, so I'm assuming that at some point you had a chance to meet him. Did you ever have a chance to work with him? Because he worked.
No. He wrote music and lyrics, and I write music and lyrics. So, you know, there was no way for us to ever collaborate. And I just met him once when he came backstage to see Hello, Dolly, and it was really like a full circle, because this was the great man that I admired coming to my show now and saying wonderful things about it to me. So it was one of the most memorable nights of my life.
You mentioned that listening to Irving Berlin's music as a child, you could go home and play it on the piano two or three songs. Were you musically inclined from a very young age?
Yes, I started playing the piano at 6, and I played by ear. And I could play anything that I heard. I'd go to the movies and come home and play the background music for my parents. And my mother knew that there was something going on with me that should be developed, and she talked my father into just letting me develop as a composer. And I started writing songs and trying to emulate the Irving Berlin style or the Broadway style that I had seen, and those songs turned into a couple of off-Broadway reviews that I had running in the late 50s in New York City, and because of one of those reviews, I got the assignment to write Milk and Honey.
Now, did you come from a musical family?
Yes, very much so. My mother was a singer and pianist, and had her own radio show called Ruth Sachs Sings, and she was very proud of that. She always showed me those clips in the paper about her show. And after I was born, she gave up any desire to continue with her entertaining. She loved being a mother and a housewife and helping my father with his business, which was a children's camp. They owned a children's camp in the Berkshires in upper New York State.
Your first big success, as you mentioned, was Milk and Honey, but you alluded to an even bigger success, I guess, the one you had in 1964, and that was Hello, Dolly, correct?
Correct. That was just a phenomenon, and still is. There is never a night somewhere in the world there's not a production of Hello, Dolly. It ran on Broadway for 7 full years. And for a long time was the longest running musical of all time. It was eclipsed by Cats, and I believe A Chorus Line. But in our 7th year, we were the longest running musical of all time. So it really was a very exciting thing for a young a songwriter to stand in the back of the theater and hear the people screaming and laughing and applauding, and it's given me a very good life.
Now, how does it work, especially in a show such as that, a very, very big show? Do you come in and write the lyrics for a show, knowing what the book is about and probably who's cast in it, or do the songs come before the cast is chosen?
The songs come before the cast is chosen. In fact, I was told that Ethel Merman might be the star of Hello, Dolly, and so I wrote a score that had a lot of what I call Merman notes in it, you know, those powerhouse notes that she was famous for. And when the time came to ask Miss Merman to come and listen to a new score, she announced that she was retiring and that she had spent her life in dressing rooms. And I had this score written for Ethel, and I was devastated, obviously, and Vista Merrick and Gower Champion, our director and choreographer, came up with a quite wonderful idea of using Carol Channing, who of course is Dolly Levi now, and it's inconceivable to think about anybody else once you've seen her do the role. So I had to change a lot of the melodies to accommodate Carol's voice, which was totally different, of course, and much lower. But I did, and I made Carol comfortable. Boy, did we have an opening night! It got the most ecstatic notices I've ever remembered a show getting, Mr. Merrick said to me that night, "Jerry, we're going to be here for 7 years," and he was right.
So you do get to work closely with the artist, as you say. You alter the songs and change them to fit.
I work intimately with every person who's ever done a show of mine, and you know, we had 7 Dollies on Broadway. And I worked with each one of them and made each one of them feel comfortable in the role and changed keys for them and did whatever was necessary to make them sound good. Because if they sounded good, I knew that I would sound good.
That sounds very giving. I would assume in a lot of cases that some lyricists might be very protective of their product. It's here, I wrote this. You come up to my bar, so to speak.
Well, that's very true, and some people are. But I learned at this very tender age that if the star sounds comfortable and happy in the role, and if she's not straining and she's not trying to sing notes that she doesn't have, the audience becomes comfortable, and she becomes more comfortable in the role, and the person who ends up really looking good is the composer and the lyricist, and in my case, that's me, because I do both.
Now, I know this is a hypothetical question, but how do you think the show would have fared if Ethel Merman had done the role?
Well, the interesting phenomenon that happened was that when we had reached the end of our sixth year, Ethel Merman called us and asked if she could now come back to Broadway and do a year with us. And so I ended up having the original star that I wrote the score for, and she was just, I mean, I worshipped Ethel Merman, so she was quite marvelous. And I put back a couple of songs that I had to cut for Carol Channing, and so I had, as they say, my cake and eat it too. It was a great way to close the show finally after the seventh year, because the last night was Ethel Merman's at the St. James Theater in New York. So you know the list of ladies that have done Hello, Dolly? Do you have time?
Sure, go ahead. Tell us a few, please.
Well, it opened with Carol Channing. Then we had Ginger Rogers, Betty Grable, Pearl Bailey, Martha Ray, Phyllis Diller, and we closed with Ethel Merman. But while this was going on, Eve Arden was doing it in Chicago, Mary Martin was doing it in Vietnam, and the list just goes on. And then, of course, Barbara Streisand did the film version. So it gave me the chance to work with about 20 wonderful ladies and get to know them personally and become, have them become friends of mine.
That was just a part of a conversation with legendary Broadway composer Jerry Herman from October of 2001. And he did indeed remain friends with the stars of his show. As you may recall in the conversations we had with Carol Channing, the two of them remained thick as thieves until her passing early last year. Jerry himself passed away on December 26th. And Stuff File program fans, you can hear the full version of this conversation by going to our Patreon page and becoming one of the select patrons of the show. You'll hear Jerry share more about his life and career, the success of some other shows, and even a few calls from listeners who were clearly fans of the legend. It's twice the length of the portion you just heard. Just go to patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File Program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. Coming to you from the outskirts of sanity, this is the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of the Bucket Bleep It list. And you know what Bleep It stands for. Also, we'll meet a squirrel photographer in Sweden. We also have an Idiot of the Day coming your way and much more Stuff File news here on the Stuff File Program, which is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher and TuneIn, and can also be heard via Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Just click on the Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify buttons located on the website at thestufffile.com, and whichever platform you listen to the program on, please feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. Well, let's get back to the stuff. Now, I enjoy the taste of Dr. Pepper. I usually have my fridge stocked with it, but I'm not fanatical about it. A Louisiana man has been arrested and charged with holding a gun to the head of his 9-year-old son because he was angry with the boy for drinking the last Dr. Pepper in the house. 39-year-old Chad Kinnaird was arrested on New Year's Day by deputies with the Ouachita Parish Sheriff's Office. The arrest affidavit states that the boy went with his mother to the sheriff's office and told investigators his father became angry at him because he consumed the last Dr. Pepper. It says Kinnaird pushed the barrel of the gun against his son's head. The affidavit also said that deputies were told Kinnaird had been consuming alcoholic beverages at the time of the incident. You know, some people might say he's a bad parent, but I'm sure his lawyer would say that he's just, you know, misunderstood. As she enjoyed an Aldi mince pie in early December, 52-year-old caterer Angela McGill of Glasgow, Scotland, thought one bite seemed particularly rough and really hard. "I thought it was a tough piece of pastry," she said. Instead, McGill soon realized that she had swallowed her partial dentures with two false teeth. Hospital x-rays confirmed the dentures were caught halfway down her throat, but the staff advised her that pulling them out would only cause more harm. It took 72 hours for the plate to pass. "It was ever so funny," she said, "and I was really enjoying the mince pie, too." Wow. Please tell me that there is no possible way that she's putting that partial denture back into her mouth. Please. Oh, dear Lord, please. I also now have a vision of those dentures re-emerging back into the world. That's a smile you won't soon forget. I tell you, you just can't make these stories up. This item was the tooth, the whole tooth, and nothing but the tooth. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, after Donna Maria Schiave failed her driver's license test 3 times in a small town in the Brazilian Amazon, her 43-year-old son, Heitor Marcio Schiave, decided to take matters into his own hands. On December 10th, he donned a stuffed bra, long skirt, and makeup and showed up at the State Department of Traffic claiming to be his mother, ready to take the test again. Aline Mendoza, the examiner, became suspicious and summoned the military police. "I thought she was drunk at first," she said. "When I realized that the student was actually a man, I decided to proceed normally and wait for officers. I think he pitied his mother for failing 3 times. Schiave was arrested for fraudulent misrepresentation and released. He may face a fine. Wow. I'm wondering, do you think if he was driving too fast during the test, he'd be considered a drag racer? Just asking. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Sarah Kinnamont is the author of a book that I really can't say on the show. It's called The Bucket Bleep It List, and you can pretty much guess what that bleep is. Hint, it rhymes with bucket. Going to Sarah's website, when you click on her About section, it states, "Sarah Kinnamont is a writer, non-practicing slut, outdoor unenthusiast, and yoga hater who lives in Vancouver, Canada." So that's where we connect with Sarah, who joins us on the line from Vancouver. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thanks for being on the program with us. Now, again, I went to your website and I saw the About, and I've got to ask, what is a non-practicing slut?
It's my kind of my funny little term that I've come up with just for, you know, having a bit of a dirty mind, dirty jokes. You know, I talk the talk, but I don't necessarily walk the walk. So I'm like an encyclopedia of useless, like, dirty joke information, but it's not necessarily coming from a place of personal knowledge. It's more book smarts, if you will.
Got you. And the other item which seems to either counter or go along with the idea of your book. You're an outdoor unenthusiast.
I am. I know, especially from Vancouver. It's like I'm like a pariah. People don't, you know, you don't have Gore-Tex in your closet. For years, I tried my best to fit in and do all of those things, which is sort of how I came up with the idea for the book as well, is I was trying to prove to myself that I could do all these things. But then I came to a point where I was doing things I wasn't really enjoying just to prove that I could do them. So, no, I don't love, you know, getting up at 7 a.m. on a weekend and spending my day skiing and being freezing. I'm much more about après-ski. That's where I came up with it. You know, I do go outside. You know, I'll walk on the seawall, but I'm not hardcore. I'm not a weekend warrior. You know, you won't see me mountain biking or anything like that, so...
Now, again, the title of your book, which is The Bucket mm-hmm. Bleep It List, and you know mm-hmm. what I'm talking about. Was there any anticipation or second guessing when you and your publishers came up with the idea for this book? Because, you know, I'm guessing there are some really puritanical bookstores that won't put the book on their shelves.
Of course. I think it's become more popular. Even as I was working on the book and I had the deal and it hadn't come out yet, more and more books were coming out with that in the title. But it was something that my agent and I had decided going into negotiations, because we'd talked to several publishers, that we were pretty firm on wanting that in the title, because that was kind of the irreverent nature of the book. So it was something that they had to agree with ahead of time if they wanted to work with me on the project. So they were supportive of it from the beginning. And of course it is controversial. Not everyone can, you know, you can't really say it on the radio or on TV. But I think it is becoming more common. You'll see if you walk into your average, you know, Chapters, there are a lot of books there with it in the title. So I think it's coming around. But for us, it was never an issue of yes or no. It had to be in the title. So
once the puritanical crowd gets past the cover and does the sign of the cross as they open the book, what will mm-hmm. they find on the inside?
It's a mix. It's a mix of like standard bucket list stuff, like, you know, going to the top of the Eiffel Tower, climbing Mount Fuji, things like that. But then there's also some really silly stuff that, you know, is not really that possible, just to give you an idea of, you know, strange things that are out in the world. Some things are a little bit funnier, more irreverent, but I think it just kind of gives you sort of an idea of what's out there in the world. And hopefully, even though it is aspirational and pretty much a traditional bucket list book, hopefully it will make you laugh and you'll learn something at the same time. You'll be like, oh my gosh, I didn't even know that existed. So I think it's a good balance between the two.
Now, some of the things that people might actually put on a typical bucket list are things that, if I'm not mistaken, you've actually done.
I have done quite a few things, yeah. So I don't really have a fear when it comes to extreme sports or anything like that. So I've done the skeleton, like the headfirst luge at Whistler. I climbed the CN Tower in Toronto and did the edge walk. I've bungee jumped, skydived, all that stuff. That stuff I find is easy. It's kind of, yeah. So I love that kind of thing because it makes me feel like I've accomplished something and it makes me feel alive. But not everyone is going to want to do stuff like that. There's more, you know, gentle things in there as well that other people can do, like watch all of the James Bond movies in chronological order. Things that don't take that kind of adrenaline rush.
By the way, I have watched all of the James Bond movies in chronological order.
Me too.
Yes.
Yeah, it took me a year or two, but I got it done. So you and me both.
And not only that, I've indoctrinated my younger nephews into the James Bond canon. And the other thing I also make them do is watch Thunderball and Never Say Never back to back.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. So yeah. There's a trick. But... that aside, since you've actually done bucket stuff worthy things, isn't it kind of blasé or a bit blasé to say the other half of your book? In other words, are you talking to people who have also done bucket list type of things, or people who have never done bucket list type of things and just like the second half of the title?
I think it's a bit for everybody. You know, it's for, you know, the goal setter, the goal smasher, who wants to do that stuff. I think it can also appeal to people that are, you know, just content to stay home and binge watch Netflix. And that's okay, too. It's not about having to be the best at everything all the time. And a lot of this came from, in my 20s, I struggled a lot with anxiety and depression. And when I came out of that, I came out of it with a sense of wanting to make up for lost time and doing everything just to prove that I could. And then I came to a point where I realized I was doing a lot of things I didn't want to do. So now I think the book is sort of a symbol of me coming to a happy midway point where I'll still do things that push me out of my comfort zone, but I'm not going to go out of my way to do things that I absolutely don't even care about just to prove I can do them. So I think it can appeal to both types of people. And you don't have to be one or the other. You can be a bucket person for certain items and an effort person for the others. I mean, it doesn't have to be all or one or the other.
Do you find that we do things, like you just said a few moments ago, because just to say that you can do them, or just to say to others that you can do them?
Of course, right? The whole Instagram thing, and it comes down to, would you do this if you didn't have your phone with you and you couldn't record it? Would you still do that? I think that's a good barometer of knowing if you really want to do it or if you're just doing it to show other people, because there is that huge thing, you know, people doing all these extreme things just so they can get likes on social media. So I think that, yeah, I mean, if you'd be willing to do it and not, you know, tell everyone about it, then I think it's a good sort of way to check in with yourself and see, hey, I think I really want to do this just for me.
Was writing this book on your bucket list?
It was, actually. This book has kind of been in the back of my mind for at least 15 years, and I kept sort of a casual little list of things just for fun, not necessarily even just things I want to do, but weird things I'd heard about that, you know, I knew other people had never heard about. So, yeah, it was very much so, and it took a while for it to incubate and then finally get to the point where I was ready to share it with people.
Well, why 15 years? What was the process that led to this long incubation period?
excuse me. It takes a while to sort of make your way as a writer. Like, it's not very easy to get published. And I had other projects I was focusing on in the meantime. And so I kind of put this on the back burner. And then everything kind of just fell into place for me. I had met my illustrator who illustrated the book, an amazing artist here in Vancouver named Jamie Armstrong. And we came together and talked about it and both got excited about it. And then we just kind of sent off a proposal. So, yeah, it just slowly built over time. And then the elements were right. We came together. We worked well together. We found an agent we loved. And then there was a need for it in the marketplace. Publishers were interested. So when everything kind of aligns at the right time, then, you know, it's good to go.
Well, congratulations on the book. The book is called The Bucket Bleep It List, or Bucket, you know what I'm saying. Everyone knows what I'm saying. And people can find out more information by going to your website and also going on Amazon.com. I thank you very, very much, Sarah, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Sarah Kinnamont, author of The Bucket Bleep It List. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0543, and you'll find links to Sarah's site, and also links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, You help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
You're listening to The Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder. Viewer discretion is advised. But then again, why are you staring at a radio program?
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about photographing squirrels. Plus, we do have an idiot of the day coming your way. And we have more Stuff File news here on The Stuff File Program, which is also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio, and also Spotify. Thomas and Eliza Malam were watching a movie in their Forsyth County, North Carolina home. It was after midnight, and they heard an intruder downstairs. Thomas grabbed a gun and sent Eliza to hide in the closet and call 911. "All my military training came back to me," Thomas said. "I was ready to do whatever I needed to do to keep my family safe." Sheriff's deputies arrived and swept the home to find who was banging around. They found the culprit, but didn't shoot. A deputy called up the stairs to say everything was okay. "Sir, I have one question," he said as he holstered his pistol, with Thomas standing in his flashlight beam wearing only his boxers. "Is this Roomba yours?" The couple's new robot vacuum cleaner had activated as scheduled and was cleaning the floors. "I think I put my face in my hands," Thomas said. The couple was grateful for the deputy's sense of humor and we decided to name our robot vacuum Harry, the sticky bandit from Home Alone. You know, I don't know if they should name it Harry. Then it might never move again.
What are you doing, Marv?
Harry, don't move.
Marv?
Don't move.
Actually, they should name it after Kevin's parents, since they too forgot the obvious. Police in Tooele, Utah, conducting a welfare check on 75-year-old Jean Suran Mathers on November 22nd, found the woman dead of natural causes in her apartment. But as they searched further, they came upon the body of her husband, Paul Edward Mathers, in a freezer chest. With his body was a notarized letter signed by Mathers and dated December 2nd, 2008, stating that his wife didn't kill him, said Police Sergeant Jeremy Hansen. "We believe he had a terminal illness." Paul was last seen alive on February 4, 2009, at a doctor's appointment at the Veterans Affairs Hospital. Investigators are probing whether the couple made the plan so that Jean could continue to receive her husband's governmental benefits. A neighbor, Evan Klein, said the story was her husband walked out on her. It was probably the plan for her to keep the money because it was her only source of income. Officials believe she received at least $177,000 in benefits over 10 years. Gee, she earned a decade's worth of cold hard cash while her husband was cold and hard in the freezer. This is the senior version of Netflix and chill. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? A little while ago in People magazine, there was a brief article about Geert Wegan, an internationally awarded nature photographer in Sweden who takes pictures of squirrels. But not just any picture of squirrels. He builds tiny sets with bait and waits for his furry friends to come by and strike a pose. Geert has published calendars and books of his photos, and he joins us via Skype from Sweden to talk about his unique photography. Hi, Geert.
Hi, Peter.
Thank you very much for being on the program with us. Now, when I saw the pictures, I got to say, they really made me smile. They really made me laugh. And then I went to your YouTube page and I saw pictures of how you do this. How did this all start for you?
It started with a fox. 6 years ago, I built my house in Sweden, and when I was almost ready, I built a balcony, and there was a fox waiting when I opened the door. And I gave that fox food, and the fox came 2 weeks every day to my home and to my garden, and I started to photograph them. And I, in the end of the 2 weeks, I made some scenes. I had a big box And the fox was climbing into the box, and I took pictures. And I won some awards with that. And after the fox, a big bird came. From the first day, the bird ate out of my hands. And I complicated the scenes after the fox because the fox disappeared. And I won also prizes with the bird scenes and was published in magazines. And after the bird, squirrels started to come.
Okay, so
continued.
When squirrels started to come, you got more elaborate with your scenes. I'm looking at a picture here. It seems like one squirrel is playing a grand piano. First of all, you make these sets yourself. How do you go about deciding? Are you very artistic yourself? Are you very handy? Because everything seems to be the right scale to the squirrel. So how do you go about doing this?
You are talking about the props now.
Yes.
Partly I make props, but I buy a lot also. I go online and look, and I learn a lot about sizes. What is the exact size? And it's not so hard. It's very difficult to find. So that's why I make props myself also.
Do you have a lot of waiting to do when you do this? I mean, you set something up and then you got to wait for the squirrel to arrive. Do you attract it by food? Is it the same squirrel, or are there several squirrels you work with?
There are many squirrels, and they don't get so old. Maybe 3 years max. So there's different generations have been, but there's good years, there's bad years. This year, last year, 2019 has been a very bad year. But so maybe four different squirrels are coming.
What is your inspiration for the various scenarios that you create? How do you, for instance, I'm looking at the one, like I said, with the grand piano. What made you think, aha, I'll get a piano?
Now, in the past, when I was living in Holland, I did a lot of concerts myself, nature instruments and nature sounds. So I love music. I love the sounds, and many things I do is my own experience, of course. And when I start a team, like say a concert, then I'm starting to think about all the instruments I can find or buy or maybe even make. And sometimes it takes years before I have all the instruments I want, and then imagination starts automatically. When I have a saxophone, I can want it only hold in the hands or blowing on it, or maybe a podium, standing on a podium, and I can make a big scenes, but also only moment scenes of single moment.
You only started or became a full-time photographer in 2013. What were you doing before that?
I worked, I did a lot of different kinds with older people, with dying people, shamanists. I did a lot of shamanistic work, healing work, a postman I have been, a builder, a carpenter, a mason. I did a lot of different kind of things.
Was photography always a hobby for you, or is this something that came later in life altogether?
No, I started when I was 16 or something, maybe 30 years ago, in black and white photography. And I had a dark room myself. I did courses, and I was a photographer for a magazine in that time, black and white photography. But I stopped when I had a regular job, and I picked it up again maybe 7 years ago.
Now, you are also the author of 8 squirrel photo books. 8! I mean, some people would think, okay, I'll do a squirrel photo book. We'll see how this goes. You have 8. Did you ever think they would be that successful?
It depends on the way I publish, because it's easy to do, like, say, print on demand, it will say that I don't have to invest. I create a book and people can buy it online via Amazon or something. So it's easy to do. And so, but I have three books published by publicists, and so that's a different thing. Then it's in a bookstore. Then it's then they are printed by the thousands instead of what I'm doing by myself.
As I mentioned earlier, I went to your YouTube page and saw some of your videos, which shows how you create some of the work that you do. Have you become an inspiration for other people to do this similar type of photography? Because it looks like it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I see that a lot of people... 6 years ago, there were some people who did this. Maybe three people in the world who really were invested a lot of time. And afterwards, I see a lot of people duplicating what we are doing, and because it's fun. It's still it's very hard to do because the right background, the right light, the right squirrel. So it's not so easy. So even people try to imitate us, it's not easy to imitate.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about technique, because as I said, I'm looking at the picture here now, the one, as I mentioned earlier, where the squirrel is playing the piano. How do you get the squirrel to pose that way? Do you put food on the piano? Do you just feed the squirrel and the squirrel just does what comes naturally to it? How do you get that shot? And how long do you have to wait for the squirrel to do what it is you want the squirrel to do?
Sometimes I don't manage the shot I'm looking after. Sometimes I start again after a year. But the piano... it's what I want. If I want to have the squirrel looking like they are behind the piano and looking at me, then probably I would put some food in the air in a small bucket, but a little bit in front in the air of the piano, because I don't want to have it too long in the end of the piano. I want to have it in the beginning. So that the piano is in focus also. And sometimes I make noises to get that moment that he's looking at the camera and behind the piano, because the foot is exactly at the point where I want to have the squirrel standing. And probably I would put some food, some seeds, maybe some nuts on the piano themselves also. So there are different... scenes I already see when I have the piano, and in that that way I put the food in different places.
When you have done these over the years, I mean, they make people smile, they make people laugh. When you look at the final product yourself, what picture can you think of that still gives you the biggest chuckle looking at the finished product?
Now, it's hard to say, but it's also my choice is how difficult it was. Like when I want to have a squirrel skiing on skis, then I want to also have the both poles in a hand. So it's very difficult to get the squirrel doing that. So if I see again that picture, what took me so long, then of course I smile, because it's quite a happy moment also, because it's almost impossible to have that moment.
I was going to bring that one up. How did you get the squirrel to ski? Because that just looks impossible.
Yeah. In that case, I try to have the snow, cut the snow a little bit on the sides. That the almost no other choice that he must go behind the skis standing, so that he's facing to me. Because if he's coming from the sides, it's useless, because he has to stand on two skis. And then I put, of course, the two poles in the snow, and I don't want to have him going from the front or from the sides. So I already boarded that so that it only can go behind the skis, go up the skis, and then a little bucket with seats in the air. And then I hope that he is trying to keep his balance when he has to climb up for the bucket, that he exactly grab two poles and for the foot to have a little bit to press himself up to the bucket. So Then I already know to doing that he's always looking to me, and then he's standing on the skis, and that he's picking the two poles. Yeah, it's a little bit of a luck moment also.
Well, again, these pictures, I guarantee they will make people smile, if not laugh out loud. They're a lot of fun. Congratulations on not one, not two, but 8 books. And people should go and look at your website. They should go to your YouTube page. I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Peter, I have a new project with Bradley Trevor Grieve this year, a new book. And he's the author of The Blue Daybreak. He sold millions of books. And I'm very happy to announce that we this year do a book, and he's the writer. He will be the writer with my photos.
Well, congratulations on that.
Thank you very much.
Geert Wiegen, the squirrel photographer. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0543, and you'll find links to his site. I'll also put a link in to his YouTube page. I really urge you to take a look. I'm sure it will brighten your day. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. And now, boys and girls, it's that moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for The Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
47-year-old Otis Latham and 48-year-old Russell Sparks of Columbus, Mississippi, were arrested on January 6th after they allegedly hatched a cockamamie scheme to win, and I'm doing air quotes on the word win, the lottery. The two arrived at the Mississippi Lottery Corporation in Flowood and presented a losing $100,000 ticket upon which they had glued the winning numbers. Flowood police arrested the pair, who were charged with conspiracy to commit a felony and uttering a counterfeit instrument over $1,000. They were held without bond. Now, why? Oh, why? Would you think that simply gluing the winning numbers on a losing lottery ticket was going to earn you $100,000 from the lottery corporation? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0543. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0543. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Let me leave you with these words of wisdom. Never, ever juggle ice picks while standing on your waterbed.